It's called Olson Empire and the Thinking of America. It has, there's one, two, three, four quotes at the beginning, so I'll read those. Spurning the clouds written with curses, stamps the stony law to dust, loosing the eternal horses from the dens of night, crying, Empire is no more, and now the lion and wolf shall cease. William Blake, Song of Liberty. Do you think that men who have enjoyed the blessing of liberty will calmly see it snatched away? Toussaint Louverture. You have no power over my body, neither can you do me any harm. Anne Hutchinson to John Winthrop in the General Court of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, 1637. This country is without hope. Even its garbage is clean. Jean Baudrillard, America. Even its garbage is clean. So the first part just lays out a few things, and then it basically focuses on this quote by Derrida. America is a world completely rotten with wealth, power, senility, indifference, puritanism, and mental hygiene, poverty and waste, technological futility, and aimless violence. That's Baudrillard's quote. While the rest of the world finds this obvious, many inhabitants of the United States seem almost aggressively oblivious to it. They continue to repeat the mantra that America is the best and that the world should pull up its socks and get on board the modern democratic hygienic express because lots of goodies are to be had, including its best-selling products, democracy and liberty. And so they drive into the sunset, one hand on the steering wheel, the other on a big gulp, ignorant of the fact they are the shimmering embodiment of an esoteric doctrine known as exceptionalism. So it goes on and it locates that idea of American exceptionalism in the developments within the American Studies Association, which was created about the same time that Olson published Call Me Ishmael. And then it argues that Olson, that Call Me Ishmael, in fact, is part of that conversation, that it interjects itself into this discourse about the nature, like the original argument is that American exceptionalism is a terrific thing. That switches in the 60s and the 70s to a deep and vicious almost critique of exceptionalism as an excuse for imperial aggression around the world. So many people track American exceptionalism to John Winthrop's 1630 speech, A Model of Christian Charity, written on the Arabella just offshore from the New World. Winthrop appropriated the biblical reference to a city on a hill shining as a beacon to the rest of the world to describe the new colony. That part comes at the end. Most of the rest of the document justifies social and economic inequities as God's will and establishes rules about money. It lays out the nuts and bolts of managing the new colony, from how to mediate disputes over ownership to the proper controls on lending and borrowing. The rules, however, are less significant than the implicit idea that you don't need God or 5,000 years of history to authorize the work of founding. A text could do it. Sack Van Berkovich points out that significantly, Winthrop did not appeal to family or to utopia, the traditional models for community. Establishing founding as textual mattered. Although it would have horrified Winthrop to think so, this gesture projects modernity beyond theory into a world without foundation and opens it to the antinomian implications of liberty. America was unique in that regard. Even Baudrillard admits it. America is the original version of modernity, he writes. We are the dubbed or subtitled version. That may or may not be exceptional, but it was the first time anyone had founded a nation without the authority of tradition or of the transcendental. Upping the ante, In 1776, the further act of founding proceeded to incorporate the intellectual pyrotechnics of the Enlightenment in its textual ground. A nation based on philosophy as it was being written by men. It was barely imaginable, a cosmological earthquake. People got excited. A vision from afar, sound, sound, my loud war trumpets, and alarm my 13 angels. Ah, vision from afar, ah, rebel form that rent the ancient heavens, eternal viper, self-renewed, roiling in clouds, I see thee in the thick clouds and darkness on America's shore. William Blake's Song of Liberty addressed the 13 colonies as angels. In the collective imagination of that moment, America opened into an unprecedented range of relational possibilities and prodigalities that, as Blake said, rent the ancient heavens, leveling hierarchies, further democratizing the authority decentered in the Reformation. Baudrillard goes on, I cannot help but feel America has about it something of the dawning of the universe. The dawning of the universe is serious business. He does not specify what it looks like, but it doesn't matter, because the dawning itself is the point, just as the textuality is the point in Winthrop's founding sermon. That figurative first light connects to an old American thinking about newness, beginning, discovery, illumination, about an opening beyond the imposed cruelties of the known, in the discovery of a new world. Baudrillard's response registers the perennial American sense of liberty from the drag of history, which is both its doom and its promise. If the founding texts result in a couple of centuries of bad faith, they also crucially preserve the possibility of rewriting the real. So then there's a part here about it's a brief random read. We're going to go introduction of Olson's immigrant status, etc., and then this. I mean, Olson comes by his fascination with America honestly. It was there, all around him, and he was living the actual dream in a way that most of us will probably never understand. I mean, he was a son and grandson of immigrants, working-class immigrants, who went to the finest schools in America and ended up at the highest levels of power. That was the promise. At Worcester Classical High School, Olson was exposed to the wild outburst of American writing from the mid-19th century. It balanced his classical education and added depth to a sense of a particular America of value. Emerson, Hawthorne, Thoreau, Fuller, Dickinson, Whitman, and Melville challenged the authority of the empire of literary forms and the thinking that is tied up in it, opening up new paths for writing and thinking in the same American space that Olson shared with them. Emerson was the heart and mind of it. Olson chose his essay, The American Scholar, as the subject of his commencement address at Wesleyan. Emerson's call to arm arose out of an anxiety about the timidity of American art and scholarship in rising to its unique occasion and producing something new from within its own specificity. The fact he thought it possible testifies to the emergence of some new spirit, one he identified with the near, the low, the common. At the same time, he proposed that American specificity as transitive, not thinkers, but thinking, which he, in fact, did. His condemnation of genius that leaves the temple to haunt the Senate or the market, and his passionate, demonstrative love of the process of thinking, its surprising activity rather than its accumulation and possession, left a deep mark on Olson. Olson's landmark essay, Projective Verse, folds Emerson's man thinking into what Olson calls the projective, which entails not only a mode of writing or even, as Olson states, a stance, but a whole new propositional reel in which such a stance can find traction. Emerson recognized the unfolding American reel in the loss of bedrock truth or law, say its textuality. Mood displaces knowledge, or at the very least casts it in its tones, leaving knowledge with no truths to grasp. Gladly we would anchor, he wrote, but the anchorage is quicksand. It won't just not hold you, it will swallow you. Baudrillard notes the other side of the modern. America ducks the question of origins. It cultivates no origin or mythical authenticity. It has no past and no founding truth. Having known no primitive accumulation of time, it lives in a perpetual present. The lack of accumulated time leaves serious conversation in America a difficult event. Without history, or at least some common representation of the past besides cartoonish myths of shared turkeys, felled cherry trees, and perennial victory, there is no given common ground from which people can begin to address each other and their situation. On the other hand, these same conditions entangle and shape Emerson's moral perfectionism, his prescient tropological morality with no foundation in law. Contradictions multiply without any hope of rectification. Contradiction against the word which is the hope of rectification, the idiocy of liberty. Emerson leverages that in self-reliance into an uncompromised, groundless, but easy engagement with the emergent world. The nonchalance of boys who are sure of a dinner, he calls it. Olson finds confirmation of that new cosmology in Whitehead's process philosophy. He works out one of its implications in his critique of inherited prosodic modes, what used to be called the laws of verse, as the enactment of a nostalgia for a non-existent ground. Prosody is cosmology, the rhythm and rhyming of knowing, and the freedom to shape prosodic form outside the given, to make something new, something that equals the real itself, becomes entangled with the thinking of liberty. Liberty is an uneasy thought these days, largely because of the duplicity that surrounds it. After nearly 350 years of slavery and its aftermath in Jim Crow, segregation, institutional lynching, and programmatic lethal violence by police, the word rings hollow. When the U.S. waves the flag of liberty while laying waste to anything that gets in the way of its expansion, liberty becomes a joke, a punchline in a story about how to distract a sucker while you lift his wallet and leave him stranded. It's an old American tradition that goes back to John Winthrop again, and his little speech of 1645. Do you know this speech? It's sometimes called On Liberty. Responding to a failed attempt to challenge his power to manipulate elections, he contracted liberty into two opposite possibilities, predictably a good kind and a bad kind. Outside the law, he said, liberty involved acting like an animal. It was common to man, this is a quote, it was common to man with beasts and other creatures, by this man as he stands in relation to man, simply hath liberty to do what he lists. A certain terror lurked in the shadow of that lists, one where animals and humans listed to do unspeakable things with each other in the tenebrous reaches of the wilderness. Winthrop called it natural liberty, gobsmacking nature and exposing it to all manner of assault. The good kind, logically consistent with his gender theology, offered an early taste of later Orwellian developments. You were to use your liberty, Winthrop said, to freely give up your liberty, like a good wife freely gives over her liberty to her husband when she marries. He called this patriarchal travesty civil liberty. Anne Hutchinson was decidedly not a good wife, in Winthrop's terms. She adhered to a religious view called antinomianism, which held that salvation was through grace, not works, and that a Christian was therefore not bound by moral law. More importantly, she refused to stand down when ordered to do so by Winthrop and the general court. She was not only a bad wife, she was disobedient. Her lawlessness extended from the theological to the domestic in a defiant assertion of her liberty from the authority of the court. In a show trial that could have been a model for Stalin's judicial monstrosities, Hutchinson was condemned as a heretic and an instrument of the devil, and along with her family and followers, expelled from the Bay Colony. They were later killed in an Indian attack on Long Island. In a journal entry dated September 1643, Winthrop coolly described the massacre of Hutchinson and her family and blamed it on them for having cast off ordinances and churches. Winthrop was surely thinking of his old enemy and her antinomianism when he distinguished between lawless animal and lawful human liberty. Susan Howe has proposed antinomianism, that lawless liberty or liberty from the law, as an elemental American mode of thinking. She locates its beginnings with two exemplary women, Hutchinson and Mary Rowlandson. In Hutchinson's case, the lawlessness is obvious. The intellectual repercussions flow out of her arcane theology into issues of the liberty of conscience and freedom from mental law. Her antinomian belief in a covenant of grace was in many ways less threatening than her refusal to recognize patriarchal law on any level, her open defiance of Winthrop and the general court. Rowlandson represents a different face of lawless. Captured by Indians during King Philip's War and held in captivity for 11 months before being ransomed, Rowlandson wrote about it in a strangely conflicted narrative. Howe proposes that Rowlandson went through a kind of reverse conversion that lurks in her text beneath the socially required rectitude of her surface narrative. She, quote, excavates and subverts her own rhetoric, Howe points out. In Howe's reading, Rowlandson's captivity exposed her to the world beyond the pale, and she tasted the openness of the wild as she relished the taste of raw horseflesh. She was set on, quote, a forced march away from Western rationalism, deep and deeper into limitlessness, where all illusion of volition, all individual identity may be transformed, assimilated. This image embodies Winthrop's nightmare of natural liberty. There's a discussion here about antinomianism and liberty, and then this. In that expansive sense, antinomianism and liberty are two aspects of the thinking of writing, as they affect the determination of the next word, how the forming of language is engaged, whether left to a habit that evades thinking, or a rule that tries to abolish death, or embraced as an articulating entanglement with the finitude of an imperfection of emerging. Howe points to the radical textual formations of Dickinson's fascicles and argues that the ongoing male editorial regularizing of her wild, eccentric forms indicates the war in American culture on antinomianism, especially on women writers. But Emerson is still everywhere in Dickinson's thinking, from his proposal for an American art and writing that announces what no man foretold, to his call for writers to upheave nature. That's like 30 years before Impressionism, right? He's calling people to upheave nature. Dickinson's challenge to the authority of thought and form answers that call. So do Whitman's invention of a new line and his challenge to the laws of Christian moralism, and Thoreau's and Emerson's invention of a new form of writing thinking, formerly known as philosophy. If liberty masks U.S. hegemonic violence with a razzle-dazzled phantasm, it is no less the thinking of freedom among words, among many other things. Its nature is extravagant and prodigal in its imperfections. What Howe calls the erasure of antinomianism in our culture is related to what others refer to as empire, at least as it metaphorically entails the eradication of difference and the elimination of resistance to a totalizing power. It came on hard and fast in America, lurking in Winthrop's rhetoric as much as in the land grabs and outbreaks of violence against the natives. Francis Jennings argues that each of the American colonies was a mini-empire, and they quickly embraced genocide against their new neighbors, playing one native tribe against another as they began their relentless expansion across the continent. In 1638, under the command of Captain John Mason, English colonists allied with Narragansett warriors bypassed a military engagement with Pequot warriors with whom they had provoked hostilities and instead attacked the Pequot village at Mystic, where they massacred over 400 undefended and unarmed children, women, and elderly. They then beat a retreat from the enraged Pequot warriors who had been waiting to fight them elsewhere till they were resupplied with arms and men and turned and destroyed the Pequots. They wrapped up this initial exercise in genocide by systematically tracking down survivors, executing captured males, and either killing the females, giving them as gifts to allied native tribes, or selling them as slaves in the West Indies. The United States emerged from the blood and enslavement of the Pequots, which arguably, America was lost. Olson confronted that loss early in the poetry. About 7 years and you can carry cinders in your hand for what America was worth, he stated in Captain Christopher Levitt of York, written in early 1958. It was a complicated kind of loss, tied up with Olson's complex sense of the destructive energies unleashed by the failure, as Emerson had it, to actually discover America. Slavery figures in it, although slavery was not the defining institution in New England that it was in the South. Olson does address it in letter 14 in the story of John Hawkins, a slave trader, and the way in which his business was part of the failure of America. Christopher Levitt, on the other hand, embodies a particular relation to the world, a stance Olson also writes about in relation to John Smith and Hawkins' father, William, who, quote, made friends among the natives, Sierra Leone or Brazil, and had such honor in the new places. Smith, another early European explorer, was significant for Olson because he was doing it for one of the very first times. It's a different thing to feel a coast, an ancient thing this Smith had, what men had to have before Pythias. This timeless mode of encounter or entanglement with the wild world, which Olson translates into his sense of the postmodern, groundless and projective, is also initial, not as time-factored, but as always further. There's a little pricey. Does anybody want to say anything or ask anything? I keep going. Want me to stop?
I'm just interested in more of that close reading of those two particular poems and how it's clear that, you know, for you in the letter 14 and the Levitt poem that Olson is, how that fits into what you're saying about the loss of the antinomian possibility or the term against empire.
Okay, I'll come to that.
Okay.
Ask me again at the end.
Sounds good.
Okay. So there's a passage in here about Olson's experience at the Office of War Information, which is, I just redacted a lot of stuff from MEO and various other places. And in fact, the only event, let's see, so he quits. It not only marked the end of Olson's political career, it marked the end of any lingering illusions about the value of the United States as a moral agent of change. It marked the beginning of his resistance to U.S. violence in all its forms, from international economic and political conquest to cultural homogenization and commodification, to the continuing war with antinomianism, to its aggressive national narcissism and ignorance of anything other than its meager fantasy of its own exceptional self. In recent years, Olson has been accused, among other things, of complicity with something called empire, and specifically American empire, a notion that circulates widely, although often without attention to questions about empire's composition or even its existence. Mostly these days, empire functions as a metaphor for evil rather than as a descriptor of an actual organization of power. The threat of the Imperial Death Star replaces discriminations of sovereignty in the discussion of the role of the U.S. in the world. Once the metaphorical fog gets cleared, questions surrounding sovereignty and empire are multiple and complex. And related to the United States, seem to come down to two possibilities. There is an American empire, but it differs from historical empires because it developed out of a new form of sovereignty. Or, however brutal the push for U.S. hegemony may be, there is no American empire because, as Walter Scheidel argues, in the most fundamental terms, the capitalist world system is not conducive to archaic flavors of territorial conquest, and it is hard to conceive of any realistic scenario that would make long-term violations of this principle appear both desirable and feasible. This is not to deny the fact of U.S. hegemony, its military interventions, its control of international monetary policy, and its self-interested manipulation of trade, but it does clarify how metaphorical distortions obscure rather than illuminate actual dynamics. Complexities aside, the analyses point to sovereignty and law as determining issues in understanding American power. They are relevant as well in understanding Olson's relation to America. A specific, unprecedented form of sovereignty developed in British North America. It differed from the forms of sovereignty that other European colonial powers imported to the New World, mostly because the various European colonizers came with different intent and encountered different worlds. In Mexico, the Spanish found a world they knew well, the enormous, complex, oppressive Aztec bureaucracy with crowns, priest castes, nobility, warriors, and slaves was much like home. Sovereignty was centralized and hierarchical. The Spanish, who were there for the loot and not settlement, took over by replacing the ruling class. They allowed large groups of Aztecs, mostly nobles, to gather for religious ceremonies. In the midst of their worship, the Spanish massacred them, as Pedro de Alvarado did in the main temple of Tenochtitlan in 1521. Once the seats of power were vacated of Indians, the Spanish invited themselves in and started running the place. one of the first orders of business learned from the Christian destruction of pagan religions in medieval Europe was raising Tenochtitlan and building Mexico on its ruins. The natives were subjugated and used for labor. For all its own particular horrors, British North America differed. English colonizers did not import monarchical sovereignty. Instead, they invented a new form based on their particular, though not exceptional, American experience. While Spain transferred its transcendent monarchical sovereignty to Mexico, in British North America, as Michael Hart and Antonio Negri point out in their book Empire, Republican sovereignty developed in relation to the settlement of a new kind of space. Sovereignty was reorganized as a universal republic, a network of powers and counterpowers structured in a boundless and inclusive architecture. While the imperial nature of the sovereignty is a subject of contention, its revolutionary structure isn't. This is a quote from the book. Against the tired transcendentalism of modern sovereignty, presented either in Hobbesian or Rousseauian form, the American constituents thought that only the republic can give order to democracy, or really that the order of the multitude must be born not from the transfer of the title of power and right, but from an arrangement interior to the multitude, from a democratic interaction of powers linked together in networks. Get that? Hart and Negri, new form of power is made rather than bestowed from above. Grounded in text, it established the common, the ordinary, as the metric of the real. De Crèvecoeur described this state of being in letters from an American farmer. Traveling through the American countryside, he observed there was no, quote, hostile castle and haughty mansion contrasted with the clay-built hut and miserable cabin where cattle and men help to keep each other warm and dwell in meanness, smoke, and indigence. A pleasing uniformity of decent competence appears throughout our habitations. He goes on to condemn both the horror of slavery and the savagery of the frontier, so he was no dewy-eyed Americanist, but he recognized something new when he saw it. The founders of America, at least the ones who wrote about it, had no problem with empire. In fact, only in the last century has empire taken on the association with evil currently identified with it. For those early Americans, the Roman Empire, with its republican structure, stood at the pinnacle of civilized accomplishment. Besides providing artistic and architectural inspiration, it became the basis of their program for using republican democracy as a control apparatus. Whether this meets the requirements to be classified as empire is less interesting than the new reality it introduced to power. Rhizomic, to invoke Deleuze, rather than vertically rooted, it operates through networks. It is constructed on the model of rearticulating an open space and reinventing incessantly diverse and singular relations in networks across unbounded terrain, as Hart and Negri observe. The experience of liberty, which everywhere infused the European air in those days, informing new thinking about self, authority, nature, economics, government, knowledge, time, space, God, is at the heart of it. Sovereignty, Hart and Negri point out, is affirmed different from the European one. Liberty is made sovereign, and sovereignty is defined as radically democratic within an open and continuous process of expansion. This new phenomenological space is free of the forms of centralization and hierarchy typical of Europe and European colonial ventures such as Mexico. It opens into a new potential experience of space-time. The question of space and time and self. What are they? What is their relation? How are we to think them past the now defunct Cartesian schema? Are central to Olson's thinking in everything he wrote. While they are given within any specific epistemological framework, they are always propositional. From Pliny to Copernicus to Newton to Einstein and Bohr, the proposition changes with the epistemology. Mythic time, circular time, empty time, shopping time, bent time, all appear in the shifting focus of mental lenses concentration. Space-time is our opening, foraying, furthering past any settlement of the moment. Olson's space, all in caps, as he engaged it in the beginning of the Melville book, register a new opening. This opening rends, shattering the integrity of feudal time with its hierarchy of sacred days and the divine wheel of their turning. It spreads out, opening as into liberty. Connected to the hegemonic narrative of the American frontier, it implicates liberty in the removal of the indigenous populations, not just from sight, but from memory. Hence what Melville in 1855 in The Confidence Man called the metaphysics of Indian hating, in a chapter wryly titled, containing the metaphysics of Indian hating according to the views of one evidently not so prepossessed as Rousseau in favor of savages. What? That's so Melville. Melville identified that hypocrisy as a poison in the heart of the United States, then in the midst of the so-called Indian Wars, the final genocidal wave that eliminated the aboriginal populations from American space. There can be no frontier if people live on the other side of it. But the frontier was only one fact of the opening as millennial event. Contradictions erupt in irreconcilable openings beyond that. In Mexico, the native populations provided slave labor for the extraction of wealth and so continued to provide value to their conquerors. In the U.S., native populations obstructed expansion and so were erased from the U.S. national cultural memory other than as figurative elements in adventure narratives or moral allegories of Rousseauian primitivism. The moral corruption of the removal of Native Americans from their land marked the birth of the U.S. in hegemonic violence. But the opening of the liberty of this new space was, is multitudinous and ontologically contradictory. While the otherness of the natives was encountered as an obstacle and eliminated, the otherness of the space-time beyond the frontier became part of an unprecedented determining experience of the real. Octavio Paz locates it as a contesting otherness beyond the range of psychosociology. That wild that Mary Rowlandson discovered herself in and in herself, the dark matter of the world that abides within the common. Paz, in The Labyrinth of Solitude, has it as the other side of reality and links it to poetry's openness. Although tied to a specific soil and a specific history, poetry has always been open in each and every one of its manifestations to a transhistorical beyond. I do not mean religious beyond. I am speaking of the perception of the other side of reality. The complexity of any moment and its irrepressible prodigality of meaning and sense is not a matter of history, a chain of causes leading to, nor is it reducible to a moral consistency. It is an otherness that fills without ever quite fulfilling while opening into the trans-historical and transnational. The hegemonic drive of the U.S. expansion across North America continued occupying space so it could expand its networks. But otherness is entangled in the emergence of this new mode of sovereignty. Liberty's sovereignty is extravagant, not allegorical. The potential spills out, infiltrating minds with potential form. Olson's space is one face of it, large, he says, and without mercy. That space and the colonizing genocidal space of manifest destiny both emerge in Liberty's opening. But whereas manifest destiny concludes at the edge of the continent, Olson's projective opens into the wild that is excluded from the United States, that natural liberty that resists any foreclosure of form in the name of law. Then there's a bit here about Olson's thinking about a scale. So history is a term that changes, and he uses it different ways at different times. And in this particular case, he uses history as a sign for the human-oriented narrativizing of events. And he talks about millennial as these large-scale movements through extremely long periods of time, the millennial. That's in the bibliography for Ed Dorn, I think he writes about this. So it's the millennial. If you're thinking millennial, then you're in a world in which there's constant movement, always. There's always been nothing but movement, people colliding, and there's always violence. However, that said, he did in a proposal for a book that never got written called Red, White, and Black, write this. He wrote a number of things, but this is his notes for the book he wrote. And then in a further note, but the first fact is that the American Indian has made a life out here in North America and South America a hell of a lot longer than we whites. 10,000 years ago he came, and from that time to 1500 AD, Anno Diaboli in his reckoning, he was boss here. Olson's recognition of 1500 as Anno Diaboli for the Native Americans clarifies his sympathy for their circumstance, but his thinking focuses largely on the wanderings of Cabeza de Vaca, who briefly crystallized an exceptional American reality, a new world in which the Europeans and Africans took up the mode of life of the Native Americans they encountered in their walk from sea to sea, integrating their knowledge of this place and living together peacefully. Having become a healer, using native knowledge and techniques, De Vaca and his companions were followed by increasingly large numbers of Indians until they encountered Spanish conquistadors in northwest Mexico. The New World ended when the Spanish gathered up De Vaca's native followers and sold them as slaves. Olson's space connects only tenuously with these historical issues. It occurs in another register of phenomenological encounter, the event of the open, free of the forms of centralization and hierarchy typical of Europe, and entangled with the process that Emerson points out goes on day and night. both spaces exist simultaneously in an irreducible complexity of contradictions without hope of resolution. Olson's space announces the end of the space and time of Euro-American modernity and the various dualist apparatuses they enliven through their separation. It embodies sheer physicality entangled in space-time as the projective emergence of the real. In that sense, Olson's understanding of history opens into a new dimension. Writing about Thoreau in the sense of Walden, Stanley Cavell observed that America exists only in its discovery, and its discovery is always an accident. And to the obsession with freedom, and with building new structures and forming new human beings with new minds to inhabit them, and to the presentiment that this unparalleled opportunity has been lost forever. This breaks my heart to read that. Given these terms, the space Olson claims in Call Me Ishmael names the encounter with the open as discovery. It is the open as specifically discovery after the closed, well-trodden spaces of Europe. Olson does not propose this space within the modern discourse of binaries, and specifically a binary involving time and history as a series of causally related moments. He moved beyond that Newtonian box of containers that hold the world hostage to their discrete, mutually exclusive measure. Time, then, not as a succession of discrete moments, not even as relative or dilated. Space, not as an empty container, not even bent or contracted. At Goddard College, Olson was explicit that it is rather quantum physics than relativity that will apply a proper evidence here as against naturalism of what Melville was grabbing onto when he declared it was visible truth he was after. For example, that life, that light, is not only a wave, but a corpuscle, or that the electron is not only a corpuscle, but a wave. Time, then, as an aspect of emergence, a dynamic field of space-time matter. Locked in the duality of time and space, imperial culture defines this spatial control in terms of temporal achievement as the apex of a narrative of history. For Western Europe, this has meant an attachment to the achieved form as a confirmation of the cultural perfection of empire. An empire of forms dictates the limits of the imagination in compulsory hierarchies of value and excellence, and within that recapitulates the forms of empire. Time becomes the time of power within the forms of empire. They are varied and ubiquitous in every register of life and thrive within the closure of the fantasy of perfection. Olson's space reopens time into the imperfections of liberty's prodigal entanglements. Space doesn't contain, it opens, is opening. The shifting forms of sovereignty mark the change of empire's achieved time of consolidated conquest into the restless networks of American hegemony, an entanglement that also yields the times of Charles Mingus and Thelonious Monk, of Louis Zukofsky and Robert Creeley, of Philip K. Dick and Diane Williams. The entanglement of resistance, the entanglement of restless imagination, the entanglement of the prodigality of the opening, the projective. We are returned to discovery as event, our event. In this sense, there is no history in the Maximus poems. even with their incessant attention to the minutiae of America's past, as he located it in often obscure texts, the past does not unfold in a meaningful order. There is only the discovery of this moment in all its richness. The texts remain, remnants of the multiplicity of space-time's diverse emergence, and the texts, when deployed within another text, begin to embody space-time in complexities of relation that undo past, present, future, say, on Madame Gross's lawn in Maximus 3, 135, where when a world is played as on strings, quote, even as that fox was seen by me, that what I offer you as now out of my right eye, myrtle, flower, and leaf are loud by presence solely and gone in the thought. Even as Olson is decentered by the fox, objectified, recomposed in the entanglement of forms of being, he is dislocated by the mass of recorded details of events that are gone, but that are here, that are here, as related in the previous three pages of the not past that are entangled in the moment on the lawn. The event is discovery, surprise, projective, liberty. There's a little more. I can skip to the end. I don't know, are you tired? You want to stop? I could stop there and leave it, but or I could just sort of sum up the end. In 1962 at Goddard College, Olson announced that poetry readings have become a bore. It's becoming a performing art. You feel as though you have an audience and as if you're supposed to do a concert or something. His unease had to do with the loss of poetry's contact with the immediate, the revelation of language's naked entanglement with liberty. The projective, not as an idea, but as exposure, the dynamic of exposure and the refusal of the disciplinary regime that emerges to limit its opening by commodifying it, institutionalizing it. In Berkeley, after several days and a series of conventional readings, Olson took to the stage with a bottle of Cutty Sark and famously held it for over 3 hours. It was a stunning, performance is the wrong word, presenting, presencing, a revelation of mind at work in all its flawed but beautiful amplitude, an offering of contact, or, as Al Glover proposed to me, a spontaneous recital in Avicenna's sense of tawil as the revelation of the soul's ascent. Olson's Berkeley tawil stunned an audience waiting for a poetry reading, including Olson's friend Robert Duncan, who famously walked out in the middle of it. It was a marvelous moment in which Olson's politics poetics came together in a stunning admission. Quote, you know, I'm the white man. I'm that famous thing, the white man, the ultimate paleface, the non-corruptible, the good, the thing that runs this country or that is this country. Olson's revelation comes in the midst of an admission of a sense of inadequacy and jealousy. Quote, and I sat in Gloucester suffering, suffering that the world had been captured by Allen and Peter and Gregory and in fact their own master, like my pound, Burroughs. Coming from someone considered by many to be one of the most powerful men in the world of contemporary poetry, a patriarchal figure, this confession in itself was deeply political in its self-exposure of the poet's weakness and humanness. It was a public outing of the duplicity of the image of implacable masculine authority. He went on to mention Gregory Corso's reading in Buffalo earlier in 1965 and revealed one source of his sense of inadequacy to be his protected existence. I never read in a coffee house in my life. I never spent an hour in jail. The statement about being a white man follows, which in this context seems to be a confession of his understanding of the way his social identity, big white male, had negatively limited his experience of the world, including access to funky reading venues. He goes on, and in fact, the only advantage I have is this. I didn't run this country, so I can stand here among men who have done what I couldn't do, can't do, acknowledging his rejection of that powerful role in the post-war Democratic Party and his solidarity with those who never had that choice. Beyond that, the implications call attention to Olson's growing consciousness and acknowledgement of the emerging democratic diversity of voices rising in America and around the world, the eruption of contradiction into the body politic out of the resistance to American hegemony, many inspired and provoked by the new American poetry, and his desire to stand among them. It announces his awareness of the inequity at the heart of American life. A few minutes later, he responds to Ed Sanders saying, "I don't like that first Maximus. I never have. Because of that goddamn principle, which is phallic. I mean, it's like a phallic image, and you know, that's a lot of bullshit." Around this time, Olson was composing the Maximus poem that begins, "I have been an ability, a machine up to now, an act of history, my own and my father's." He goes on to identify his own immigrant past. "My father, a Swedish wave of migration after Irish, like Negroes, now like Leroy and Malcolm X, the final wave of wash upon this desperate, ugly, cruel land, this nation, which never lets anyone come to shore. If it is a filthy land, a foul country, where human lives are so much trash, the eternal disappointment, it is also still potential. The United States does not, in other words, control the final determination of America, that endless potential of liberty, and an end to hell, end even to heaven, a life America shall yield, or we shall leave her and ask Gloucester to sail away." That was long, I know. Sorry. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, Olson was very aware of that difference between the rise of merchants and the bourgeois in the British 17th and 16th century as against the conquistadors in Spain and in Britain and Holland, and that accounts for the difference that we are all aware of between the conquest in North America and in South America and Mexico.
I'm sorry, just give me a little brief, sorry, I was a little distracted. Olson was aware of the North European...
The fact that the rise of the bourgeois class, the merchant class, and was first centered in England and Holland, as against the Spanish, still principal. And with that, the centralization of the state came and was hidden in a Republican or Democratic state, but it was still there, a centralization as against the feudalism of separation before the absolutization of power in France under Louis XIV. And Olson was certainly aware of the loss of space as the expansion continued, and the limitation of the great space. And partly because literally the populations increase, lowered individual space. amount. Yeah. There wasn't as much space anymore.
Yeah.
And that's what the loss that some people think was Olson's message, final loss and disappointment.
Yeah, but you see, he date in the Christopher Lovett poem, he dates that loss well before that particular circumstance comes into being, right? He's talking already. He's saying 7 years, like by 1637, it was gone. It was gone. Whatever possibility was there as an open possibility, it was gone. And that had to do with the change from someone like Levitt, and I think whose imagination was open to the encounter with this utterly new experience, as opposed to the colonists who come in the second and third waves, and some that's just business as usual, like they're just bringing all the old shit with them, including the general court. Yeah. I think that the Negri and Hart book is really interesting. I don't know if you're familiar with it. I found it really interesting because this book. It's called Empire, and they are both Hart and Negri are, I suppose, well, Negri's not. Hart's an interesting guy because he's the American translator of many of those French philosophers, from Deleuze and Guattari to Negri to. So he's very well versed in the postmodern philosophical thinking, and Negri, of course, is right in the heart of it as a sort of ex-Marxist. And the book—it's an interesting book because it's initially I had a hard time with it because I have a hard time, given my own history with Marxist analyses. But they do a really good job of translating Marxism into a sort of it's still slightly ideological, but it's not tied to the kind of mechanistic dynamics of Marxism. It's open. And that notion that it's a new kind of sovereignty. It's not primarily defined by a relation of a top and a bottom, in which authority, you know, goes from the top down to the bottom.
No, the authority though circulates, but nevertheless there is that stability of centralization.
And there's stability,
yeah.
And there's it's not quite centralization. That's the thing that they argue. You see, centralization was a function of the state, of the nation. Which was that a modern invention.
Well, this is a period of the growth of the idea,
yeah,
of the nation, which was still stuck there.
Well, I know that. But what they're arguing is that this is the beginning, I think this is what they're arguing,
yeah,
is that America is the beginning of the end of the nation. It's the beginning of the end. Because and we in fact are in a circumstance in which the nation as an entity is pretty much subverted in the face of institutions like the International Monetary Fund.
Exactly, that's the absolutization of globalization.
Yeah.
And that supports the state.
So the networks networks infiltrate out and undermine you, so you've still got these things called nations, sort of, but they're kind of dysfunctional.
As I was listening to you talk, I have to say that I'm not nearly as well versed as everybody else in this room these issues, so I'm sort of groping in the dark here.
We're all groping in the dark, trust me.
I'm really groping.
Yeah.
But as I was listening to you talk about Winthrop and your interpretation of what kind of liberty and all, I kept thinking of the Mayflower Compact, in which they were asked to subsume their own individual interests for the organization, the entity of the colony. And that didn't seem to, I didn't see logically how you went from there, began with there and went up to where you went. I mean, it seemed to be a bit of a contradiction, and I just wasn't sure about that. He did seem to bring with him Mayflower, or that the colonists brought the Mayflower people brought with them the concept of nation and sovereignty, and expressed it in the Mayflower Compact that we subsume to a, you know, higher authority kind of thing.
They did, and I think that the what Hart and Negri are arguing is that the and Susan Howe with her example of Mary Rowlandson is that the encounter, and this is Olson as well, that the encounter with this new form, this new experience of space, was determining. It ended up determining the way in which the forms of life emerged and the forms of sovereignty emerged. Even though there are clearly, you know, textual remnants of references to old forms and so on and so forth, but they don't develop the same way. And the Republic, I think this is sort of crucial to Hart and Negri, is that the very idea of the Republic already is based on the dissemination of power in a structure of networks rather than its centralization in a central figure. And that's new, that's different. I mean, it's different even in Rome, basically, but and it becomes even more different.
The other comment that I would make is that his reading, if he said that at a reading in Goddard College in 1952?
62.
Even so, he was practically a future fortune teller. I mean, I can't imagine what he would think of literary life today if we thought that was a performance back then.
Oh, listen. Oh, yeah, we don't want to go there.
But, I mean, did he... I'm wondering if, you know, his predictions about where life and, you know, the world of... the idea of a life of ideas and books and their role in a culture, he talked about where he thought that was going other than the performance.
Well, he's certainly aware of commodification. Nothing like what it is today, but not only in the literary, but in the so-called art world.
Did he anticipate how far it would go?
Yeah, this is. I didn't read this part, but I'll just read this. It's a quote from one of his poems. This is. This is about the experience in the Office of War Information, what happened to him was that he, or my understanding anyway, from what I've read, is that he really did harbor, when he went into that situation, he still harbored the idea that the United States could be a force for moral order in the world, democratic moral order. And his, the job that he takes up in that circumstance is to, he's given the job of mobilizing Spanish-speaking Americans to support World War II. So his sense is he'll go in and he will renew democracy, the spirit of democracy. He will get people fired up about democratic relations and renewing democracy and the necessity to defend that against this threat. And so the way that his bosses respond is by hiring a bunch of Coca-Cola salesmen from Madison Avenue to come in and take over, right? And they start censoring his work, and they won't let him say what he wants to say, and eventually he quits. And this is a poem, this is somewhat later than that, but he writes, rather than write ad copy and sell American hegemony, he resigned. Oh, statue, oh republic, oh television, the best is soap, the true troubadours are CBS, Melopoeia is for Coke, by Cokes, out of paws. Well, he's pretty hip to what's going on.
He wasn't the only one too. I mean, that was a whole shift in in the effort of the Office of War Information. It shifted within the war effort. Others had a similar experience that he had. It's a shift.
You mentioned that you thought he was rather prescient.
I'm sorry?
You had mentioned that you thought that even back then he was looking at things that he was rather prescient.
Yes.
Well, yeah, what you're talking about here is, of course, he quit. He quit the government when Truman came in. And he did that, if I'm remembering correctly, you guys know better than I do, he did that, and there's some quote somewhere where he could see the way that things were going, because Truman, he saw the New Deal being abandoned, and he saw that happening as soon as Truman came in, and he saw the way that things were going, and he called Truman, or he believed that Truman was like a shopkeeper on Main Street.
Yeah.
There was some quotation there that basically what was going to happen now was everything was going to become a complication, everything was going to be sold, and that ideals were going to be abandoned, and that everything was going to work in terms of... Correct me if I'm speaking...
Well, no, that's absolutely right.
Yeah.
So what did you mean by precious exactly?
Prescient.
Oh, prescient.
Not
oh, prescient.
Yeah.
Okay. Here, I'm thinking Lord of the Rings, my precious.
Yeah, but that was a real moment for him. And that's when he said, screw it, I'm going to become a poet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Imagine going in there today and wanting to build up the democracy.
Yeah.
Get shot down so fast.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And it's even worse where I come from. I know, I don't know if it's worse, but it's just as bad in Canada right now.
I mean, he would actually rage against billboards.
And Muzak. Don't forget Muzak.
Muzak and billboards were a tremendous offense.
Well, they were the actual degradation of the real world that you're in, right? That's it. There it is. You don't get any more immediate than that. I'm sorry, John. Did you?
James.
James, sorry.
Yeah.
I don't know if I ever answered your question.
No, I think so. I mean, I can go back to the poems as well. You cited them, but I think so. With the question of empire and especially thinking of how we look at a figure like Levitt and other figures in Maximus' poems, I think what exactly Olson is seeing in their intents and their actions is, I think, an open question. You know, I think it's not always clear in the poems, and I also think it's I think that's an area of examination, certainly that Yepes doesn't get into. He doesn't read that closely,
yeah.
But I certainly think that how we read founding figures and how Olson sets up this figure as, you know, sort of a heroic figure, or a figure after which things shift and change. I sometimes think there is something to be looked at in, and I don't know the specific, Levitt isn't a figure I've looked at, but closely, but I do think that's something worth looking at. Like, what exactly does he think he's praising there, and what does he think has shifted?
Yeah.
I do think those are legitimate concerns in those poems, you know, because it's about it's about what's possible and what are some alternative possibilities for where we've gotten ourselves.
Yeah,
possibilities and those things are not. That's my question is in that, you know, what was it exactly about Levitt that had been lost?
You know, I think it's not. I don't think of it as a this is not like the landmark moment where it's not like that. I don't think it's like that. I think it's emblematic because the particular, I don't know what you want to call it, the mode of being or the stance or the relational activity that he points to over and over and over again is, you know, it's constantly erupting in the world. So it's not like it all ended in 1637. But Levitt.
What is it? I guess what is his particular? Why this particular figure?
Levitt is Pleistocene man at that moment. You know, like I don't know if like Pleistocene man is the figure of our initial encounter with the possibility of inventing the world.
Sure.
And there's Levitt having the same opportunity, or John Smith having the same opportunity.
Yeah, isn't it frustrating that you know, we can't then you have to, then what's going to happen is, if you think you're inventing the world, you're going to kill the native people. That's going to happen. Because you're inventing a world. No, that world actually already exists. Well, there is a world. You're encountering you're negotiating, you're bringing a world with you, and you're negotiating a world that's there, right? But to say, you know, the place to see that's, I think that's where...
Well, you see, Cabeza de Vaca was emblematic of another way of that possible
absolutely.
Encounter.
Right.
And Hawkins' father, William Hawkins, was someone who traded... You're not ever going to stop encounter and change and conflict and violence.
Why isn't that more present than Olson's War? I mean, that's a frustration. And you know, I mean, I love, you know, the end is great. And there's so much, I mean, there's so much there that's good. But I do think we need to recognize that there are moments where this making a world stuff and the figures that represent that are not accounting for the fact that we're actually someone bringing a world with them, and that they're encountering space, sure, they're encountering character, but they're also encountering a culture. And then what are the implications naturally of that happening? That those moments aren't always understood in the poem. Nor would I possibly expect that they would be by someone of his age and time and the invention of all this. And he's at a frontier. It's easy for me to sit back and, you know, and judge, and there's so much progression and ongoing activity in his writing, right? He keeps coming back to things. But I do think those are legitimate points.
They are legitimate points, and I actually kind of tried to address them in a part that I didn't read to you. I won't read it. I know I read enough. But he's reading Brooks Adams' The New Empire, and looking at this whole. I mean, he takes it all the way back to Mu. Right? I mean, not only are populations of people moving, but continents are fucking moving. Everything's moving all the time. And there's always conflict. Always conflict. Wherever this movement meets some other movement or stability or whatever. I mean, that's his main focus. And that is not a focus that invites a kind of moral vision. Which is not to say that he didn't have a level of moral vision, because that's what comes out in the writing about this proposal about this book about red, white, and black, where the moral vision is evident. But his mind is operating on multiple frequencies that we don't usually think in terms of, and we especially don't think in terms of it if we're all self-righteous and moral about, you know, hurting people or whatever, right? I mean, Lord knows it was a genocidal, catastrophic event for Native people. It was terrible. There's no... And if you're looking on a human level, it's, you know... But his focus is almost always on what he calls the millennial, because what he's interested in is, how do we get here? What does it mean that we're here? What does it mean to be here? What do we do now? You know, and there is a moral element to that, but it's not the moral element that, like, he can't write poems about feeling bad about what happened to the Pequods. That's not the scale that he's operating on when he thinks about this stuff.
But I think then you get, I think you said that at one point, that the history then is sort of, you know, connects only then loosely with these, right? These figures then are always going to be problematic because they don't quite fit the millennial vision, right? If you're going to deal with this individual as an emblem of the, you know, the Pleistocene man of the situation or this, you know, right? You're, on the one hand, you're using history as data, right, to give an example of, but on the other hand, you're really, if your concern is that the larger vision is this, that this is a example of this larger fully set of forces and processes, then it's not going to fit, right? The history is not going to, the more one drills down into it,
yeah,
the less it'll have these other features to it that make it.
There's another consideration which I wrote about it at one point and then I cut it out. But I don't think you can actually rule it out, which is that by 19, literally in the United States, native populations disappeared. They disappeared. They disappeared from memory. I mentioned that, right? By the turn of the century, by 1900, there were no more native people other than as cigar store Indians and, people in Santa Fe selling trinkets. That was it. That was who Native Americans were. They were gone. I grew up in a town in Southern California where there was a fucking residential school. Now residential schools in Canada are huge. Like, it's a huge issue right now. There was just a big commission, Truth and Reconciliation Commission, about it that came out with all these. Because it was awful. I mean, it was just awful what those schools did. And there I am. It's called Sherman Institute. It's kind of down Magnolia. We drive by it, and my mom says, that's the Indian school. Like, that's what it was. It was the Indian school. I mean, you didn't see any of the Indians. They never got out of the school. The school was just a school. There was no consciousness or any kind of living memory of Native people, in the same way that there is in Mexico, where they're everywhere. They're totally central to every sort of cultural moment. There's Indians there to remind you of the past, but that didn't happen here. And when Olson's writing in 1940 about space, there's no Indians in the collective cultural consciousness. I don't think there were particularly.
Well, the British conquered and so forth. The idea of genocide was impossible, because there was no question. Christianity was superior.
Yeah.
And these people were lacking, absolutely lacking, in an absolute way, to be whole, God-given people. They weren't, because they weren't Christians. Christianity was absolute, north and south. And therefore, these people should be treated probably well, which they weren't. But they were not Christian people. They weren't from until they got baptized and became organized as Christians.
And so they had to be saved.
Yeah.
I think that it was better for them in Mexico, because Catholicism was more flexible in terms of being able to. There was more paganism in Catholicism than there was in Protestantism.
Well, especially that pernicious brand of Protestantism.
John Calvin had such a huge stick up his ass.
There were still all the reservations and people who lived and worked in the communities around the reservations, in places like upstate New York where the Mohawks were, and in Arizona where the Hopi and the Navajo. But I think your point that as far as the consciousness of the American people, the assumption was that there were pockets of Indians, but they didn't exist as a force to be acknowledged or understood or anything like that. So they were so marginalized that people didn't realize that there were these rather substantial pockets of people. And certainly in Alaska and the Northwest Coast, they still have very strong.
There's more, yeah.
But still very much, if you said something, if you had an Indian host, everybody would say, no, of course not, because they didn't see them. They didn't know to notice them. But
they weren't there. They might have been in Santa Fe or,
They were in the general population.
Yeah.
But they didn't say, I'm an Indian.
Yeah.
And it was, not until maybe the 70s when Indians felt like they could say, I'm an Indian.
Yeah, it was Wounded Knee.
Yeah. And when you could actually say something and people would look at you cross eyed, like, what does that mean? But I think Olson's point is, it's important.
Anyway, I just raised that because it occurred to me that I don't even know how much Charles Olson knew. I mean, how present were Native Americans in his imagination of an America? Because they had pretty much been eliminated from the popular imagination.
but he includes it in the conception for this book.
He does.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, so he's, I mean, other people aren't even thinking of it. So, in that way, and the statements you read up. So I'm not, I don't want to project, you know, anachronistically onto what.
Yeah.
But I'm also, in a sense, trying to have some, you know, because I too was, what Yepes is wrong about a tremendous number of things, but the bringing this question up, which is something that many of us, you know, I'm not
it's a good
young person anymore,
yeah.
But
yeah,
certainly I thought about while reading Olson and these poets in Toronto that you speak of, and other people that I encountered, people visiting, writers of Latin American descent at various times who visited here. And it's something we talk about. And
yeah.
Not, and again, it's we talk about it in critical ways, you know, as you've done too. Not to say that this is right and let's revise ourselves in, but why such a line of thinking would be interesting, but not as a way to then dismiss Olson.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Not as a way to then say, this is a guy we don't have to deal with. This is a guy, because he's an early and interesting thinker in so many ways and opens up possibilities in so many ways to think through so many of these things and so many other areas of poetic inquiry are just lame and dead ends. These are rich and exciting still for you know, someone like me and other people. So thank you for that. But I just, that's where I'm coming from.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I totally hear you.
The Indians are certainly there in popular imagination with children's books that Olson read, Al Shuler, and Cowboys and Indians, where it was an archetypal American thing in the early 20th century. So the imagination of the Indian was constantly reinforced later by Western movies, but by children's games all the time.
Oh, I know. Like, that was my Indian. My Indians were the ones who were fighting, you know, John Wayne.
Feathers and maybe sheep.
Yeah, who got to be the Indian in the game, right? Like that. But that's different than the awareness of the social oppression and violence.
Yeah, yeah.
Also go. I'm
sorry. Sorry. What?
No, no, no.
What was that?
You sparked a couple things, and I'm still trying to get my head around them. One of them was that big long word I had never heard before, which was a type of liberty that's actually closer to chaos.
Antinomianism.
Say that again.
Yeah.
Antinomianism.
Antinomianism.
Yeah.
Which was a word that I never heard before tonight. And you compare that to the other type, which was a sort of, you said, if you kind of think about it, what it is, it's an actual repression of liberty by everybody agreeing to give up the
surrender
of absolutely free liberty, which would mean that everybody lives how they want, everybody does what they want, everybody.
Yeah.
So the antinomianism, if you will kind of equate to chaos with everybody doing whatever they want to do.
Yeah.
But what, I can remember his name.
Winter.
The guy who wrote Winter.
Yeah.
So he wrote this thing and he said, well, this is bad. This other kind is good because everybody is coming together and sort of democratically agreed this is what we're going to do. Now, then you went into how Native cultures were suppressed, kind of because they didn't fit in. Correct me if I'm misreading this.
Well, it's not so much that they didn't fit in, it's just they had to be eliminated.
They had to be eliminated. All right, yes.
And then forgotten.
Yeah, and then forgotten, yeah.
But doesn't Olson, and I don't know as well as you do, doesn't he also go into, as a part of the history on Gloucester, how some true mavericks, who were actually original settlers, original Puritan settlers, were suppressed in the same way by the Puritan community, and I'm not going to remember names, but I remember reading it. Folks moved up to Gloucester, and they set up a sort of collective group where they were working together to fish and to sort of. Am I wrong here?
The Massachusetts Bay Colony was not famous for being colonized.
This is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So some moved up to Gloucester, and they set up this small kind of collective, and the Massachusetts Bay Colony came up, and I think it was Miles Standish himself who came up and said, no.
Yeah, no, Well, that's Hawthorne's story, right?
Yeah,
that's Hawthorne's story. The maypole. The maypole of Merrimass.
There's a lack of knowledge of true Indian civilization and what was lost, you know, in history. But if he was reading Melville, I mean, you know, in Moby Dick, Melville recovers in a very interesting way that lost memory by the crew, the Pequod, the Gayhead Indian, and the mysterious ways that they had with, you know, interacting with their world and the way they viewed the vastness of nature and stuff. So it was. That seemed authentic. It didn't seem to be sort of mythologized by Western media like Cowboys and Indians and that all thing.
In Melville.
Very, very authentic.
In Melville.
So,
and the name of the boat, the name of the damn boat.
That understanding.
I know it's an interesting question. Like, I can't answer that. Maybe Garrett can answer the question. I mean, when you read Call Me Ishmael, I think there's like three mentions of Native Americans or something like that, and two of them are to Tashtego. I counted these at one point, who's a member of this crew and who is emblematic, who's part of an emblematic assembly of democratic people from around the world who have now become actually subjugated, you know, to Ahab's malevolent intelligence. And then the other mention is the Pequod. And he mentions the Pequod, which is the name of the boat, which is also the name of this founding genocide, right? Like, Melville knew damn well what he was doing when he named that boat the Pequod. That's like it. There it is, you know, in one word. And Olson, he never comments on it. Now, I don't know why. I don't know if he missed it. It's hard to imagine that. I don't know why. But that said, whatever the reason was, shortly thereafter, he writes these notes for Red, White, and Black, in which he's talking explicitly about Native Americans as part of this relationship between Africans and Europeans, and the negotiation of some new form of life based on respect for the people here that were encountered here. So it wasn't, I just don't think that we are almost post-60s, we are almost just instinctively, knee-jerkedly moralist in our relation to these questions. No? Like, we are. And that's not a bad thing. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. But we can't even have this conversation about this issue without feeling some kind of moral location in relation to it. You know, we can't. We can't do it.
I think it's that idea that we are situated in relation to it. Like, my life is situated, as is Olson's, as an immigrant, and, you know, the child of immigrants and so on, and you've made that situation. I think we do situate ourselves, and we should situate ourselves. You know, and that doesn't mean then, I think then we can begin to have conversations once we've situated ourselves. And I hope that's the thing that comes out of, you know, you're doing this work and talking to other people about it, that can we then engage figure like Olson and talk about these things and his sense of, you know, the possibilities in America, or, you know, Susan Howe, even we could talk, you know, we could do a whole thing about who she chooses as American heroes too, which for me is often problematic too in other ways. That's what I'm talking about today.
Yeah.
Because we have because she's situated relative from her family history and so on, relative to these figures and so on.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean then the conversation doesn't stop with our situations, and we're not defined by our situations, because there were certainly possibilities beyond.
Yeah.
But that we need to acknowledge that, you know, how we are situated biographically and geographically and with privilege and so on relative to those things, and then we can begin to talk.
I'm totally with you, 100% with you. You're a very reasonable man.
I add only that we look at it as in some ways too much of a monolith, or monolithic, because the the Iroquois and the Massachusetts Bay colonists were really a very good match. They're very warrior-like, both of them. But in Pennsylvania, the settlers encountered the Lenape Indians, who were very mild, who were relaxed and friendly, and so were the settlers, and they got along. They still disappeared from the face of New England, you know, for many reasons, but I remember somebody saying to me, you have to remember at the time, the Indians were the enemy. We were afraid of them, and, you know, afraid of what they would do. Of course, they were afraid of what we would do.
Well, they were afraid,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and so in some groups, Massachusetts Bay, it didn't work out. In Pennsylvania, it did, but they still disappeared. And it's still, you know, it makes you wonder in a larger sense of, human groups have their own history, and we encounter it at certain periods, but we're not going to alter it.
Yeah.
I think what you say about the peculiarities,
that you brought up the particularities, because I agree, and this is something Olson, I think, would also, which is why he's constantly revising himself and constantly rethinking.
Yes,
he's constantly
absolutely.
Reading, he's constantly finding out some new bit of information and needing to deal with that, and the way you just went into particulars is like perfect. For me, like that opens up conversation, you know, and gets us to talk about those particular
things.
These are the two paragraphs that I didn't read to you. I'm going to read to you now. Like, Olson's attention always focused on the big picture and what it revealed about the otherness of our circumstance. His sense of the violent historical conflicts between peoples was contextualized within his thinking of migration as the constant fact of the human. Migration, in fact, there it is, right up there on the wall, right there. Migration, in fact, which is probably as constant in history as any one thing, migration, always leads to a new center. He is careful to keep his feet on the ground, specifying it as the pursuit by animals, plants, and men of a suitable environment. On this scale, though, movement problematizes moral judgment, since the forces involved are inhuman. Humans merely move with and within the inevitable and perennial process of the world. Olson took one of his leads here from Brooke Adams' proposal that the two great migrations, or as Adam calls them, expansions, defined Indo-European history, driven by revolutions in metallurgy, radical new technologies, one extended from 3500 BCE to 284 CE, during which time assorted empires rose and fell to the delight of later historians, and the other from about 1000 to 1897 and after, which included the invasion, conquest, and settlement of the Americas by Europeans and the birth of several actual empires. In his Bibliography of America for Ed Dorn, Olson contrasted this view of the orders of time, which he called millennial, to what he here called history, another word that takes on multiple meanings in his thinking depending on his focus. Here, humanism defines history both in scale and content. It gives coherence to the made-up story of the human. The millennial opens into movements on a scale that render the human insignificant, which is not a bad thing to do for us. We really need to think of ourselves and the world as insignificant, so that we can stop this nonsense, you know? The millennial migration is constant. Flows of people up out of Asia and across what became Europe, flows of three huge drives from the polar north down onto the three legs of the future, flows across the Bering Ice Bridge and down the west coast of America in one violent, displacing wave after another, none of which invoke moral angst. Nobody gets moralistic about what the natives did to the natives, ever, right? Ever, under any circumstance. We don't get upset about it.
True, exactly. When we dig into particulars, we do. Not in large scales of people, but people who study this stuff do. They have, you know, interesting conversation and moral feelings.
Well, I have no feeling, I have no disagreement that they have moral feelings about it, but we don't condemn
sure. and close conversations down because somebody takes this position or that.
You know, I guess this is my big thing right now is like moralism. You know, everything that I seem to do these days has in some way or another taking on moralism, which is just the end of intelligence, you know? It's the end of intelligence. Once history is out of the way, the millennial reveals a world of perpetual motion that, if you push it back to Pangaea, as Olson does, is as much geological as it is biological, or say, a determining order of the cosmos, a prevailing habit of the real. Flows slow and seem to stop, but the movement just shifts scale. New centers form from micro to macro, and around them stable structures. Then migration becomes centralized, hierarchical, and stable, till some other wave or expansion, some multitude on the move, crashes into it, and the pieces scatter.
Yeah, so it's like the whole notion of worldwide pandemics, you know, it's beyond the realm of morality. It mows down indiscriminately, you know, and changes the whole course of history, social destruction, formulations of what history might be. And these type of things happen, you know, it's like a media strike or whatever, you know, there's this mass extinction of the dinosaurs in our times, you know, it's going to hit us, you know, and climate change, you know, and it's going to be, we're going to have to drop our moral indignation, you know, and start saving ourselves.
Yeah,
know?
Well.
It's easier if you can think in those big terms, cosmological terms, but then we become less significant.
We do become way less significant.
Yeah.
And a little more clear-sighted. You know?
It's part of this. I mean, now it would be considered part of this philosophical moment called, objectivism or objectism? The Derek Harmon and these guys who proposed that we need to relearn to think ourselves as simple objects in a world of objects.
Olson says that in Projective Verse.
I know he says that. He says everything. He says everything. I gave that, like, I had these students who were like totally into Derek Harmon and this and this whole philosophical movement, and I gave them Projective Verse and it blew their minds.
Among the big ideas and what I heard throughout this, I think I heard the emphasis on process over product, constant change, evolution, and eternal present, longs in the present. And I like what you said about it almost makes it hard for us to talk to each other because we're coming out.
Yeah.
And but nowadays the theory is all about self-organization, emergence, I heard you say, presencing, quantum, the whole world of relationships.
Yeah. I've been reading part of that stuff in the paper comes out of this book that I lent to Garrett called Meeting the Universe Halfway by a woman named Karen Barad. I don't know if you've ever heard of her. She's really quite a stunning thinker, and she has. I was telling Garrett she has a PhD in women's studies and a PhD in quantum physics. And so she brings Judith Butler's the subtleties of it are still a little bit beyond me because I'm only about halfway through this book, but she brings the Judith Butler's gender performativity, the way in which meaning is part of the emergence of an activity in the world. She brings that into bear in terms of quantum physics and an argument about the universe itself as being tied up. It's all got to do with her reading of Bohr, of Niels Bohr's experience. Because Bohr versus Heisenberg, there's this argument about what the two, you know, the two-slit experiment in physics? Yeah. So there's an argument about what actually happens at that moment. And Heisenberg's argument was that what happens is that we look at it and it changes. And Bohr's argument was that we create, we are entangled with the event. And it's not that we look at it and something happens. It's that we are part of the emergence of that meaning. Mm-hmm. You know? So there's a fundamental different... I mean, that's pretty radical. Just stop and think about it, you know?
Again, Olson was there.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's from the Goddard quote, right? Like, he's...
Yeah, he's there with the quantum... Yeah. I mean, he was incorporating the latest quantum physics discoveries back when they were happening, because that all sort of slotted into this living in the moment, or part of the moment, and being here now, and his whole man is removed from that with which he is most familiar, right? And so we're kind of separated from the fact that we're here now, and instead we're out buying things instead of being,
But I also think that moment, that being here in this moment, this is actually a long moment. If you don't compartmentalize it, you know, it's like it's a continuum. It's unbroken. So the past is still part of the present moment. That's why I always got the sense that Olson tried to hang on to that. That's why he didn't want. That's why loss of memory. You know, like the destruction of.
Yeah.
Constant renewal and destroying of the old and the past and forgetting about it is very bad, because actually it's part of this one long moment.
That's right. It's absolutely you lose your connection to the ritual
time. You know that if we lose track of that, we're in more peril.
You have to think like a millennial, though.
Yeah.
Well, I related it. I didn't put it in this particular version of the paper, but I was reading Jean-Luc Nancy's book on Hegel called The Speculative Remark. Do you know that book? It's a really interesting book. It's really interesting to watch this happen in Europe as that, like Hegel's out one year and the next year Hegel's in, right? Like that. So they're all rediscovering Hegel now. And the thing that he's writing about there is this comment that Hegel makes about sublation. I can't remember, there's a German, famous German word, Aufbeg or whatever. But he's talking about sublation as the moment, this moment, this is the moment in which something is both destroyed and preserved simultaneously. Like, what we think of as the past is not the past, it's this moment in the dynamic of its destruction and preservation of what's happened. I mean, it's like, here we are, And it just hit me because I read the Olson poem about being on the lawn, and he's got like three pages of detailed events of Gloucester. This house came down, somebody built a house here, this happened, all around this lawn that he's lying on at this moment with his feet pointed towards the harbor. And you realize at some point this is not about the past, this is about the present, right? Being aware, like being, knowing who you are and where you are.
Looking around you and seeing the past orients you in the present.
It does. Mm-hmm. And it's not the past then, right? It is the present. That's the thing.
Yeah. Time that's come up,
and what happens when they tear it all down and turn it into Salem or whatever is that you completely lose your ontological ground, your grounding or your orientation or whatever, right? You lose it because it's gone.
But then there's knowledge that comes from being on the spot, right? Like you know.
There is knowledge, yes.
Something happened, and so there's that kind of collaging of time all of a sudden, right? That you're on this spot and you're on that other spot simultaneously, across the street, right from the museum, there's that art pocket park, right? That the museum gave us on the spot of a house, among other things, the Pierce family house, who were... West Indian traders,
okay.
Right? And the uncle of which made the molasses, the molasses into rum in town, So, but that spot, so our museum, right, took down one of these buildings.
Yeah.
But one can now stand on the spot still and contemplate what, sort of, how do we get to this moment where, you know, an abstract sculpture of a bird that doesn't exist in Gloucester is on the spot of this valuable building across from the museum. And so, but it can be very orienting to know that in a way, because I know where I am culturally too, in the way of like, what's valuable at this moment and all these things, which is why that kind of work that also did, or the kind of work that anyone might do to dig up the names of the tribes that you just mentioned, for example, when I'm in Pennsylvania in that spot, I know something about that spot that maybe I didn't know before tonight about, you know, what went down here. And, and it, that kind of composting and layering, it might give us the closest thing that my body can experience to the millennial sense, you know, especially if I then think geologically and so on too, that I can kind of get my fix on my bodiness in the larger time and space. You know.
So I think it fits in. I think it fits into Olson's growing relationship, his increasingly complicated relationship with Blake as well, because Blake proposes that fourfold vision, and I think. You know, once Jack said to me, I don't know, we would have been drinking or what, he says, you know, Charles didn't do it in the end. You know, he said to me, what didn't he do, Jack? Well, I think what he didn't do was he didn't finally reach to Jack's satisfaction the articulation of the fourfold. That the threefold is there, and even glimpses of the fourfold in volume three, but he didn't quite. Well, that Jack was a harsh critic, right? Jack Clark. He said the same thing about Duncan. Duncan didn't do it. he got close, but he didn't do it. So, but what Blake proposes is that we move, that there's states, visionary states that we move in and out of in our lives, and there's what he calls single vision, which is a complete narcissism. There's the state of Olo, which is a state in which his image of it is a man and a woman tied together back to back. So it's a world of dualist contest, a world of good and evil. And then the Beulah, which is threefold vision, is a sexual vision, a sweet, compromised land, one which is gives you a break, but it doesn't. It's still not part of what he sees as the fourfold, which involves these immense blows of intellect in eternity, the mental war. It's not in a bad sense. Then it's like war, like it's what we're doing now. You know, like we're engaged in a mental war in which we exchange blows. But we do it nicely, right? Like it's like. So the fourfold is a state, and they're not. I don't think they're levels. I don't know that Blake talks about them as levels. They're states. So they're all on the same level, but you move in and out of them. And the fourfold for him is the final state of poetry, like poetry. That's what Jack. You know, Jack wants. Challenged me, he said, you have to go to the Air Force Academy. You have to go to the Air Force Academy and live there. I said, what do I have to go to the fucking Air Force Academy for? He said, because, you know, you're too leftist. Like, you gotta go, like, shed some of that stuff, you know? And he's right, because you can't, well, he was concerned with the epic poem. And you cannot write the epic poem. And for Jack, the epic poem was absolutely crucial to bringing into being a new proposition about our condition. That the poet could do that. Come up with a proposition that actually was an intervention in the order of our lives. But you had to go to the Air Force Academy to be able to do that. So.
Can you repeat the book, Meeting Something Halfway?
Meeting the Universe Halfway. Karen, B-A-R-A-D. She's great. You know, she's got this fabulous YouTube video, too. You can look her up on YouTube.
I hope someday we'll be able to read this at our leisure. It was wonderful to hear it in your voice. I don't know. I mean, I could have gotten the same out of it.
Thank you. You will be able to. Yeah,
Is this going to be on the website podcast?
We'll see what the quality of the video is, but if it actually.
The Writers Center website usually has these talks on podcasts, and I can, you know, because what you read and presented will have to be, for me, have to be slowly listened to over and over again to slowly digest, because there's huge, you know, epochal chunks of,
The thrust of it was to try to layer on a sense of the complexity of these issues as actual dynamic issues in our lives, rather than simplistic moralized ideas.
Right. Of course, yes.
I still can't remember that big one.
You know, what kind of rent my mind was sort of like the promise of America is innovation, novelty.
It's okay.
Terrific.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Bye. No, just the notions of America promising the chance of innovation and novelty and change and the democratic, the democratization that evolves from that, where you don't have these hierarchical power centers that just, you know, dominate your lives for generations.
Yeah.
But that there's America, unfortunately, it goes in all kinds of different directions. But, you know, you can have General Motors could be the largest corporation in the world 30 years ago, and it goes out, almost goes out of existence.
I know.
Because there are other competitors, and change has overturned that order. And you've got other rich people and new, you know, people who are making it, and, you know, so the... You don't get these static levels of you know, hierarchy and stratification. And so there is still the promise. That implies still promise and hope, you know, that we can work our way, continue to work our way out of whatever dilemma we're in, as opposed to other societies that, you know, was completely hopeless, you know.
Yeah.
It would have to totally collapse.
Yeah.
And something come out of it completely new, out of the chaos, but... So I'm just saying, my overall impression of your talk, I just kept on getting these images of that, you know, in terms of, like you were saying, you know, because morality cannot withstand the reality of global pandemics or climate change.
We have to be clear. There's a difference between morality and moralism. Okay, so Emerson. What Stanley Cavell calls Emerson's moral perfectionism is tropological rather than legal. So moralism is always legal. There's a law, there's a rule, there's some kind of code, and you've broken it, right? It's like Huck Finn, you know, on the raft there, and he's got the note in his hand, you know, and he's thinking, I broke the fucking law. I stole this slave. No, I got to turn him in.
Right.
If I don't turn him in, I'm going to go to hell. Like, because that's the rule, that's the law. And then he goes, to hell with the law. Right? He's my friend.
Yes.
And that's the moment of tropological morality that Cavell calls moral perfectionism in Emerson, where it's the face-to-face.
Yes, it's the immediacy of the situation.
That's right.
It presents what you need to do.
Yeah.
The right thing to do.
That's right.
And you're not blinded by just representations of the real, which is indoctrinated into your mind and blinds you to, like, the reality of the world.
Yeah.
So you commit horrible crimes all the time, you know, blindly. You know, you're constantly injuring and destroying, and of course, you know.
Well, hopefully you're doing more than that, John. Hopefully there's a little on the other side happening there, too.
Yeah, well, of course, yeah. But, I mean, so far, you know, we're
I think it's 50-50.
Well, that's absolutely right. But and who knows what's going to happen? I have lived my life. I have lived a life in which catastrophe has been a remote possibility. I have not experienced it. I've not experienced war. I mean, I was a draft dodger, but even that wasn't a war. You know, it's like when they tell you that your duty during wartime is to keep shopping, you know it's not.
You're
it's
right.
A different kind of war, right? Like,
yes.
It's like a different kind of war.
Yes.
It's unusual. You know, it's unusual. And it's got to change. I don't want it to change. The dream is that the possibility that was opened by the idea of America could stabilize, you know, our relations in such a way that we would no longer be subject to those violent eruptions and rents in our lives. But I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure that's not just a pipe dream. I mean, go for it, but on the other hand, we've been really lucky.
Well, when you listen to Chomsky and the projection of American moral authority and power in the rest of the world, the catastrophe, the reality of catastrophe is happening all the rest of the world, everywhere, and we're creating it.
Yeah, well, Chomsky...
We're living in our own sort of dream of you know, this...
You know what? It's so fucking complicated. I write about war movies. I like war movies. And I wrote a piece on Black Hawk Down, which is a fabulous movie. I don't know if you know it. Ridley Scott.
Yeah, I've seen it. Yeah.
And he captures the whole complexity in the opening moments of that movie, where you've got modernity in the shape of America with this base. It's huge. It's all open. It's paved. There's these immense stretches of open space everywhere and big planes sitting there in the midst of it, right? All this technology in the midst of this open space. And then there's downtown Mogadishu, which is like everywhere you're inside a closet. Like it's just tight, tight, tight. And when the attack comes, or the opening of the operation to pull this guy out of Mogadishu occurs, the helicopters come flying out of that space across the desert, and there's these kids, like these Arab kids, or I don't know if they're Arab or what. No, they're waving at the helicopters, and the helicopter guys are waving back, and then as soon as they're gone, the kids pull out their cell phones, and they call into Mogadishu and tell them, hey, the helicopters are coming. So, okay, what world is this exactly? Is this some world where there's a clear distinction between modern and pre-modern and post-modern? Or is this a world where whatever happened in the 17th and 18th and 19th centuries, whatever that was, has resulted in a complexity of techno-human experience that is... We don't even know what it is yet. We don't know what it is. No? Two guys, one guy in a cheap nylon shirt with an RPG brings the entire American military machine to its knees. Right? One guy.
Right.
Boom. That's it. I tell my students, like in Toronto, I teach in these classrooms where it's like the United Nations. No? There's people from Iraq, people from Iran, people from China, people from South America,
Canada
people from...
Canada has a very good immigration policy, unlike the U.S.
And I tell them, you know, you guys get all mad about colonialism and shit. And, you know, yeah, they do. It was a lot of bad shit happened in colonialism. But guess what? We wouldn't be here in this room talking to each other right now if it weren't for colonialism.
Right.
So who's going to make the judgment about the final value of all that incredible uproar that happened? Who's going to make that call in this room now? You know, this guy's crazy. This old white guy is like,
Well, you know, the change is inevitable, and migration is inevitable, and the movement of, you know, it's a.
And the United States and Canada, more so Canada than the United States, but both of them are utterly new in the sense that they have created a civil space in which difference is the basis of relation,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, every once in a while in Canada it erupts, like the Serbians will get all pissed off at the Croats or something if there's some war over in Europe. And then everybody goes, Jesus Christ, shut up, you know, you're in Canada now, you're not over there, this is different, it's right. different over here.
These ideas can be contested immediately and challenged, you know, and then when it's unchallenged and uncontested, when you have homogeneous ethnic groups, you
yeah.
get deluded into believing that, you know, you're right and nobody challenges
yeah.
you, and then you go off and do something terribly destructive.
And so far, nobody has kicked in my door in the middle of the night and hacked my arms off with a machete because I'm in the wrong political party or the wrong tribe or the wrong religion or the wrong whatever, you know? Yes, okay, it's oppressive in many ways, and yes, there is a dynamic of repressive tolerance that is for people like us who are alert and interested and engaged with trying to bring some kind of tropological moral vision into the world. It's not the best of all possible worlds, but guess what? Whoever said it was going to be the best of all possible worlds,
right.
you know?
It just gives
like,
us a chance. So where are you going to take this writing? Are you going to is it published or is it?
It's going to come out. Benjamin Hollander is going to publish it in a book of letters and essays to Olson.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. If you want to email me and I'll send you a copy, I'm happy to send it to you.
Gary, have you emailed?
I'll give it to you before you go.
All right, great. Well, I got to head off. I got to work day tomorrow, but thank you so much, Lucy.
Thank you for your work.
Thank you,
you know,
for coming.
And thanks for visiting from where? Toronto now?
Toronto, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Great to meet you.
Yes, great to meet you too.
Great to see you. And thank you.
Yeah.
Good. Well, we'll be in touch.
Yeah, I'm here for two more days, so we've got to get together before I go, okay?
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, like, we can maybe hang out some afternoon or something.
Yeah. I'd love that. Yeah.
Thank you so much. That was good.
You're very welcome. Thank you for
I'm
coming.
I'm glad there are people thinking about these things.
Yeah.
I hope there are many circles like this.
Good to see you guys.
I do, too.
Spread the ideas.
Yeah.
It's exciting. Thank you.
Just one second. Garrett, can I ever give you a copy?
Thank you.
James, thank you for coming.
Sure.
Thanks your questions. Yeah.
No, thank you for answering them. Then,
yeah.
It's
crucial in a way, you know?
Yeah. No. It's,
no, thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. Lots to chew on. In a lot of notes. So, thank you.
I made my point badly.
Yeah, I think I knew where you were.
What I was trying to say was this sort of...
I'm listening.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You actually did something that I didn't think was possible. That was you... Are you still being recorded, by the way?
Oh, yeah, maybe. I can turn it off.
These two concepts of liberty that you presented just blew my mind. They really did.